This is VOA News. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey. Suspected jihadists have massacred at least 114 civilians in Burkina Faso's volatile north in the deadliest attack since Islamist violence erupted in the West African country in 2015, officials said Saturday. President Roch Marc Christian Kabore denounced an attack near the borders with Mali and Niger, where jihadists linked to Al-Qaeda and Islamic State have been targeting civilians and soldiers. The worst attack occurred during the night of Friday to Saturday, when armed individuals staged an incursion into one town that left 100 people dead. Terrorists killed civilians of all ages and set fire to homes and the main market, according to the government. It said its defense and security forces are at work to, quote, neutralize the terrorists and restore calm to populated areas. The authorities have declared 3 days of national mourning ending Monday night. Venice's first cruise ship since the pandemic is seeing protests Saturday by activists demanding the enormous ships be permanently rerouted out of the fragile lagoon, especially through the city's historic center due to environment and safety risks. Italian Premier Mario Draghi's government pledged this winter to get cruise ships out of the Venice lagoon, but reaching that goal will take time. Venice has become one of the world's most important cruise destinations over the last two decades, welcoming ships carrying nearly 700,000 passengers in 2019, according to a cruise line data. Passengers are headed towards a week-long cruise with stops in the Greek islands of Mykonos and later Croatia, but they will also meet groups of protesters before leaving Venice. You can find more on these stories and the rest of the day's news at voanews.com. And follow us on the VOA mobile app. This is VOA News. The United States, Britain, and other leading nations reached a landmark deal on Saturday to pursue higher global taxation on multinational businesses such as Google, Apple, and Amazon, in a move that could raise hundreds of billions of dollars to help them cope with the aftermath of COVID-19. The Group of Seven, or G7, large advanced economies agreed to back a minimum global corporate rate of at least 15% and for companies to pay more tax in the markets where they sell goods and services. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen says the, quote, significant unprecedented commitment would end what she calls a race to the bottom on global taxation. The deal, which was years in the making, also promises to end national digital services taxes levied by Britain and other European countries, which the United States said unfairly targeted U.S. technology giants. The measures will need to find broader agreement at a meeting of the G20, which includes a number of emerging economies, due to take place next month in Venice. India's government Saturday warned Twitter to immediately comply with the country's new social media regulations, which critics say give the government more power to police online content. Twitter is involved in a tense battle with the Indian government, which has often asked it to restrict content, alleging Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government is trying to silence criticism, including of its handling of the coronavirus pandemic. India's Electronics and Information Technology Ministry says new rules came into force on May 26, but the social media site so far hasn't complied. It asked Twitter to treat Saturday's warning as a final notice, otherwise the company shall be liable to consequences, an Indian news agency reported. The new rules require internet platforms such as Facebook and Twitter to erase content that authorities deem unlawful and to help with police investigations, including identifying the originators of, quote, mischievous information. And three U.S. senators will visit Taiwan on Sunday and will meet its president to discuss security and other issues. Taiwan's government and the de facto U.S. embassy in Taipei said on Saturday, a trip that will likely irritate China. The United States, like most countries, has no formal diplomatic ties with the island that is claimed by China, but it is its most important international backer and supplier of arms. Senators Tammy Duckworth, Dan Sullivan, and Christopher Coons will visit the island on Sunday as part of a larger trip to the Indo-Pacific region, the American Institute in Taiwan said. The country's president will meet the three at the airport on Sunday morning and express thanks for the show of support, especially at a time when the island is dealing with COVID-19. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
Take a decision that will affect millions of our youths who have no official job, but who are trading, doing little businesses, doing small-scale businesses on Twitter, and will just wake up and render them jobless. It is totally insensitive.
The Nigerian government indefinitely suspends the operations of Twitter in the country.
There is support. In fact, I talked to some young people just before the interview, and they say, we don't even care if the World Cup Tribunal is located in Ghana. We are ready for it.
The Liberian Bar Association demands a war and economics crimes court to address atrocities and gross human rights violations during the Civil War.
They are doing things illegally. That's not their mandate to start suspending political rallies. The COVID in Zambia is not as how they portray it. It's being over-exaggerated, I mean.
And Zambia's main opposition party rejects a ban on public rallies in the run-up to the August general election. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Nigeria, the main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP, is calling on President Muhammadu Buhari to reverse the indefinite suspension of Twitter operations in the country. The opposition party says the ban appears to be a way for the administration in Abuja to muzzle Nigerians from speaking on national issues, which it contends undermines the country's constitutional provisions for free speech. Concern Nigeria, a political pressure and human rights group, has condemned the suspension of Twitter operations. It says the move aims to silence media reporting and restrict the fundamental right of citizens to have free access to information. Other groups say the suspension appears to be a ploy to divert attention from the increasing number of insecurity challenges the administration has failed to resolve. Announcing the suspension of Twitter operations, Nigeria's Information Minister Lai Mohammed says the social media platform is being used to undermine the country's corporate existence. Kola Ologbodiyan is the spokesperson for Nigeria's main opposition PDP. He tells me that the ban on Twitter is yet another indication that the government is running out of ideas to resolve the myriad of challenges facing the country.
The reaction of the People's Democratic Party to the banning of Twitter by the All Progressives Congress-led President Muhammadu Buhari administration is that this is an absurdity. And this shows clearly that the administration of the All Progressives Congress, led by President Muhammadu Buhari, has become short of ideas on how to run governance. It is strange that the same All Progressives Congress and President Muhammadu Buhari, who won the hearts of the youths in 2015 to win election, can pay back Twitter by banning the organization from exercising its business concerns in Nigeria. It is rather unfortunate.
Bakola, Lai Mohammed, the information minister, has accused Twitter of double standards when dealing with Nigeria. Do you think his criticism is justified?
Contrary to the claims by Alhaji Lai Mohammed, the action which the federal government has taken against Twitter is totally unjustifiable. As a matter of fact, what we are witnessing in our nation today is a descent to the Stone Age. And if care is not taken, and if Nigerians don't resist the action of Mr. President by condemning this act, it will be clear to us sooner than later that our nation will soon become a pariah state. And as a country who has spent over 20 years in democratic culture since 1999 till date, it is unacceptable, it is vexatious, it is ugly for us to be returned to in fascism.
Announcing the ban, Lai Mohammed said the ban is due to the persistent use of the platform for activities which he said is capable of undermining the country's corporate existence. What is your take on this coming from the information minister, Lai Mohammed?
Mr. Lai Mohammed should come out and define to Nigerians the activities on Twitter that is capable of affecting the corporate existence of our country. It is not enough to deploy words. It is not enough to describe situation in empty threats. It is not enough for this government to lie against the youth of this country. And I believe strongly, and I hold the opinion of the People's Democratic Party, that there is nothing that could be said that Twitter has done that can damage the corporate existence of our nation.
Human rights defenders and civil society groups are saying that the ban of Twitter operations in Nigeria infringes on their constitutional right to freedom of expression. Is this the stance of the PDP as well?
It is the stance of the People's Democratic Party that the action of the federal government against Twitter is repulsive, and it's also an attempt to halt the freedom of expression as clearly enshrined in the 1999 Constitution as amended. It is also an attempt to halt Freedom of Information Act as established in the Act of the National Assembly. It is totally unacceptable, and the People's Democratic Party is demanding that Mr. President should resign immediately the action of his administration in banning Twitter.
Bakola, do you see the president, and for that matter, his administration, rescinding this decision as the PDP is calling for him to do?
Expectation is that Mr. President will rescind the decision to ban Twitter in Nigeria. Because it's one decision that is going to affect the already worse economy of our nation. There are a lot of business activities being carried out by the youth using the Twitter. And for the federal government to just wake up one day and take a decision that will affect millions of our youths who have no official job, but who are trading, doing little businesses, doing small-scale businesses on Twitter, and will just wake up and render them jobless, it is totally insensitive.
Kola Ologbodiyan is the spokesperson for the Nigerian Main Opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. The president of the Liberian Bar Association says the establishment of a war and economics crimes court will help end impunity in the West African country. Tiawan Gunglo says his group is working with civil society and other groups to mobilize about 100,000 Liberians to demonstrate across the country on June 24. The aim, he says, is to demand the establishment of such a tribunal as leaders present a bill supporting the proposal to lawmakers in the capital, Monrovia. Tiawan Gunglo tells me that it is unacceptable for anybody to thwart efforts to create a court to prosecute those responsible for committing atrocities against citizens and gross human rights violations, including murder, during the country's civil war. He adds that a war and economics crime court will help create respect for law and order and serve as a deterrent to future generations.
The only way to end impunity in Liberia and to prevent further impunity is for those who committed atrocities during the war and committed economic crime to be brought to justice. As I speak to you, the Bar Association has gone ahead and drafted the bill and has sent it out to other lawyers in the world. And we have a bill now to present. On June 24th, we'll be mobilizing not less than 100,000 people in Liberia to submit the bill to the national legislature.
What do you think are the prospects of establishing this war and economic crimes court?
I think between From 0 to 100%, I can tell you right now, even at this stage, there's about 90% prospect of establishing it. Because already 52 members of the lower house, the House of Representatives, have signed a resolution calling for the establishment of the court. And mind you, there are 73 members of the 73 representatives in the House of Representatives. If 52 have signed, well, that's more than two-thirds. So, you know that people are ready for that. And in the Senate, there are senators now, including Senator Darius Dillon and others who are advocating for the establishment of the War and Economic Crimes Tribunal. So, and everyone you talk to, as I speak to you, I'm speaking in the city of Ganta. You know, Ganta, Nimbakane is one of the places that bore the brunt of the war. Every county in Liberia suffered, and in Nimba, people are gearing up. The evidence is I'm speaking, people are listening to me, and they are virtually, like, you know, clapping for me.
Why do you think this War and Economic Crimes Court has been delayed in its establishment? And do you think there's a political will to have it established?
This is a democratic country. When the majority of the people who voted, those who are in power now, in office, say this is what we want, there is nothing they can do. This is not a military government. This is not a monarchy. This is a people's government. So they must govern by the wishes and aspirations of the people, and we'll make sure it happens.
After this 100,000 people that you call in the street on June 24th, what's next after this massive show of support for the establishment of this Economic and War Crimes Court?
After that, we'll be lobbying members of the Senate and the House of Representatives to actually enact the law. And when the law gets to the table of the president, we will also lobby to make sure that the president signs. We are very clear that any lawmaker that does not support the War and Economic Crimes Bill will not be re-elected in 2023, which is the time for the next election, because we strongly believe that the sustainability of our peace is tied to fighting impunity. As I speak to you, the police is challenged in Liberia. Every now and then, a police station is burned. People take the law into their own hands because they know that there are people in government who kill thousands of people and are going scot-free without anything happening to them. But when one person commits aggravated assault, you go to jail, which is a contradiction in terms of commitment to promoting rule of law. There is selective application of the law because there are perpetrators of war crimes and crimes against humanity, as well as economic crimes, that are dictating the course of governance in Liberia. It cannot continue.
Do you think the call for the establishment of this court has a groundswell of support across Liberia?
I am speaking in Nimba, and it's important to know Nimba. Nimba is where Senator Prince Johnson comes from. And I'm happy that you called me to do this interview while I'm in Ganta, because there is a misperception, a very wrong impression, that no one can talk about war crime tribunal in Nimba. I am in the most popular town in Nimba called Ganta. And I'm speaking here without fear or favor. And people are around me listening. I just told them to be quiet. Money changers and the rest of them. Yeah? So yes, there is support. In fact, I talked to some young people just before the interview, and they say, we don't even care if the World Crime Tribunal is located in Ganta. We are ready for it.
Tiawan Gonglo is the president of the Liberian Bar Association. He spoke with me from Nimba County, Liberia. In Zambia, the main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND, says it will not accept a ban on public rallies in the run-up to the August 12 general election. It comes after the Electoral Commission of Zambia announced the measure as part of the effort to limit the spread of the coronavirus. This as health authorities warn about rising number of cases of the disease. But the UPND accuses the electoral body of bias in doing the bidding of incumbent President Edgar Lungu and his governing Patriotic Front. The Electoral Commission denies the accusation as without merit. The UPND and its alliance partners, including the National Democratic Congress, say it will continue with its political rallies to campaign for votes despite warnings from the electoral body. Attorney Emmanuel Malite is the spokesperson for the NDC in alliance with the UPND. He tells me that the Electoral Commission's directive is a political ploy to suppress the opposition alliance before the presidential and parliamentary elections.
We can't respect that rule and will not abide to that. What we've decided is we're going on with the campaign throughout and campaign. But what the ECZ are doing is literally they are following the direction and the directive from the president. A president who is also a candidate. And you know, when a candidate says something, it will be a political statement.
But Emmanuel, there are concerns that political rallies, a perfect place for the spreading of the coronavirus, and that was done to save the lives of Zambians. Why don't you want to take this and campaign using social media platforms, regular media, radio, television? Why do you want to insist on campaigning on public rallies where the coronavirus could spread among your own supporters?
We are using every means, social media, public media, private media, whatsoever. We are using door-to-door campaigns and also the rallies. But the issue at hand, why we've rejected that, Zambia is not the only one that has conducted elections during this pandemic. We had elections just recently in Malawi when COVID was at peak. Malawi did not cancel or ban rallies, political rallies. They held rallies and they emphasized on people to follow the guidelines, health guidelines of the COVID. Congo was holding held elections. Tanzania held elections. Not to talk about US, where US was recording the highest number of COVID patients and deaths. They conducted these public rallies. What's so special about Zambia that you can suspend rallies, which is a constitutional right for political parties to participate in this? That's why we're saying ECZ is acting on behalf of the Patriot Front, which is very unfair. And our appeal is now to the international community, those international election bodies, to monitor the current, that the level playing field of these elections are not free and fair.
Some people are suggesting that if you value the life of your supporters, why don't you tell them not to congregate at a large place where the coronavirus could spread?
COVID in Zambia is over-exaggerated. It's not what the numbers are, and we question the numbers that now that we are in an election that they have started increasing the numbers and they're announcing the numbers, the Minister of Health. We have a place in Lusaka called Soweto. It's ever-crowded all the time. People there don't even mask up. Bars in Zambia operate 24/7 without face masks, and any COVID guidelines have never been followed. Why now that the ministry and the ECZ are so much interested in the election, Peter? The reason is very simple. The UPND is attracting more numbers on the ground than the PF. When I take you back, the president was commissioning the bridges in Lusaka, where himself has been masked up, but his political cadres were all over like it's a rally. They were not masked up. And we complained to the Minister of Health. Why is it that the head of state cannot caution his cadres to mask up? And they were quiet. Today, a head of state is now a candidate. He issues a directive, and an institution and a commission called ECZ should jump to his decree. That's why we're saying no. That man that we see, Ed Galong, is also a candidate. He should not start dictating the commission. The commission, as it stands, is supposed to be as impartial and as separately from government decrees.
Will you not be putting your supporters' life in danger if the police or perhaps other security agencies crack down on congregating at these public rallies that you plan to be holding ahead of the elections?
I want to emphasize on the fact that we are not saying we are going ahead with public rallies. No. We don't want to find ourselves in a situation where they've disqualified us in these elections. What we are saying here is the commission, which is the ECZ, have compromised in their and they are doing things illegally. That's not their mandate to start suspending political rallies. The COVID in Zambia is not as how they portray it. It's being over-exaggerated, I mean.
Attorney Emmanuel Malite is the spokesperson for the Zambian opposition NDC in alliance with the UPND. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Zimbabwe's Supreme Court has ordered the release of two opposition activists who spent 8 years in prison for allegedly murdering a policeman. The case has been decried as an example of the government using the justice system to silence and punish critics. For VOA, Kutsai's Vanavashi reports from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Last Mayenga Hama and Tungamirai Mazokere were acquitted Friday and ordered released from Chikurubi Maximum Prison. They were charged with two other activists, Rebecca Mafikeni, who died in prison, and Yvonne Msarurwa, who was released in a presidential amnesty for the stoning to death of a police officer by an opposition mob in 2011. The defendants said the court ignored video evidence that they were not present when the incident occurred. Msarurwa expressed joy for the release of fellow activists, but questioned the timing.
I am so happy for last Mayenga Hama and Tungamirai Mazokere. I think I'm now free from this case. I cried when I heard that the boys have been acquitted. I'm just thinking aloud and I'm like, really, Rebecca is gone? And today they're saying we did not commit this. Honestly, I don't have much to say. Just say, welcome last Mayenga Hama. Welcome to Tungamirai Mazokere. Rebecca Mafukeni, may you continue to rest in peace.
Fadzai Mahere is the spokesperson for the opposition MDC Alliance.
While we are happy to see them free, we certainly do not celebrate the suffering that they had to go through, the persecution, 8 years at Chikurubi prison, having to endure hard labor. This is a loss of dignity that can never be compensated. The only reason that last Mayenga Hama and Tunga Mazorera were behind bars is because they were members of the MDC. They chose to stand up and oppose the government. They weren't even at the scene of the crime, and yet they were found guilty unjustly. And obviously, today the Supreme Court has said what we've said all along, that this murder charge against them was baseless. It was without substance. There was clear evidence to show that they were innocent, and yet they were persecuted.
Doug Coulthard is a lawyer and a human rights defender who has been representing political activists accused of breaking various laws.
The fact that it took ultimately 9 years for this matter to be resolved and for them to be acquitted is a massive indictment against our judicial system, and that, you know, that someone's liberty can be wrongly taken away from them for almost a decade. They can sue for civil damages for the malicious prosecution and the wrongful detention.
The courts also recently nullified the case of Terence Majengwa, an activist who spent 60 days in pretrial detention after his arrest while staging a protest at the Harare Magistrates Court. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashi from Harare.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Crotty, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in South Africa, the National Prosecuting Authority, or NPA, is calling on Interpol to help arrest members of the Gupta family, which is accused of corruption. The investigative directorate of the NPA says Interpol should arrest and deport the accused members to South Africa to face charges including fraud and money laundering. The call comes after it issued warrants for the arrest of the Gupta brothers, Atul and Rajesh, and their wives, as well as Chetali, Ati, and their business partners. But the Guptas have denied the charges. Supporters say the charges appear to be politically motivated. Meanwhile, the investigative directory says it has successfully seized assets and properties belonging to the Guptas and their business associate, estimated to be worth $39 million. The seizure includes luxury properties in Johannesburg and Cape Town. It comes after a Bloemfontein High Court granted authorities power to seize the properties. For more on the calls for the international arrest of the Gupta family members alleged to have engaged in graft, I read Sindisiwe Seboka, spokesperson for the Investigating Directorate of South Africa's National Prosecuting Authority.
Essentially, the National Prosecuting Authority is investigating directorate for the five-year term to investigate and prosecute state capture-related crimes within the country, has brought an application and is currently speaking to a feasibility study that was paid from the Free State Department of Agriculture in 2011 to 2012 for feasibility study of the possible success of the Mohuma Mubung project. The company Nulani Investment, which is owned by Iqbal Sharma, then subcontracted it to at Deloitte for $1.5 million. And then we believe they subcontracted again work already done by Deloitte to another company, which we then believe then transferred funds to Ironsights, a company owned by the Gupta brothers, Abdul and Rajesh Gupta, as well as their two wives. So what we are alleging is that they need to come back to South Africa. A warrant of arrest in South Africa has been issued. They have been mentioned in a charge sheet in South Africa, but they need to come account for those particular crimes in the Bloemfontein Magistrates Court. And we say that of the 17 accused, four appeared yesterday. And we are alleging that the Gupta family should then also come and account for the accused for looting the Free State Department.
Some people are saying that this call is part of a witch hunt by political enemies of the former president, Jacob Zuma. What's your reaction to that when you hear such criticism?
So the investigating director for starters is led by a formidable person, Advocate Hermine Grenier, who has been saying that we do not bring half-baked matters before any court of law. So this particular investigation, we stumbled upon when investigating something else, and everything came together, and it shows the flow of the money, of how the money left the country, how it left the jurisdiction, how it entered into various, and how it got into the control of Atul Gupta in South Africa. It shows that he had control of an Absa account where he micromanaged how money came in or was laundered and how it left South Africa. So we're saying we've got facts. We've already told the Bloemfontein Magistrates Court, which is in the Free State, that we are ready to proceed with trial with those that are actually before court and in South Africa. Currently, the docket has already been completed. Investigations have been completed, rather. So we're saying, how can it then be a witch hunt when we have all the evidence and are ready to continue with trial?
Have you gotten any positive responses from Interpol following your call?
We're saying that the application is still ongoing. We are also saying that we're using various other means, but the application is still something that we are pushing towards. So feedback is quite premature to even talk about feedback, but we're saying for this particular case, we'd like the Gupta brothers to come, place their views, their opinion, their defense into this particular case, because from where we are sitting, as the National Prosecuting Authority's investigating director, we feel we have a concrete case and we cannot wait for it to then be transferred to the High Court where it can be ventilated, but we need them to come back and account. We are still saying, should they wish, if they're innocent, let them come into the country and then account for this case, because they then have a case to account to. Let them come and make their case. That door is still open.
I understand the NPA has also gotten a court order to seize assets, including luxury properties in Johannesburg, Cape Town. Can you confirm this latest development?
Yes, we got the order issued by the Bloemfontein Free State High Court, which issued the order on the 2nd of June in favor of the investigating director that the assets of Island Site, in particular the company owned by the Jewish Adu and their wives, as well as Munani Investment, a company owned by Iqbal Sharma, somebody who's already in South Africa, to account, as well as the business rescue practitioners, because we are aware that Island Site is currently under business rescue. So the order has been served on the business rescue practitioners. The order, we have to also mention, is an unlimited order that we got from the Bloemfontein High Court.
Can you assure South Africans that these investigations that you are carrying out, or the NPA is carrying out, is devoid of political influence and political machinations just to bring down the Gupta family being targeted because they had close relationship with former President Jacob Zuma?
Not at all. We deal in cases on a case-by-case situation, and the evidence leads what exactly it is that we then bring before a court of law. Our investigative strategy has always been working with law enforcement as a secondment basis, the NPA obviously leading from a prosecutorial aspect, and then joining the dots on how exactly money came in and out of the country. We're also using various other law enforcement agencies and external parties. SARS is also, the South African Revenue Services, is also an aid of the investigating directorate that follows the money. So with all of the evidence-gathering measures that we're using, we are not at all instituting any form of a witch hunt, but it's the money flows that we're following.
Cindy Siwe Seboka is spokesperson for the investigating directorate of South Africa's National Prosecuting Authority. She spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. In Uganda, a leading civil society figure says citizens are hopeful an inquiry to investigate the attack on Transport Minister General Katumba Wamala will help apprehend the assailants. Godbert Tumushabe, head of the Great Lakes Institute for Strategic Studies, says there's reasonable hope that the involvement of President Yoweri Museveni will bring results. His remarks come after the government announced the formation of a 7-member joint cooperation committee, an investigating team tasked with speedily launching an inquiry into the attack. The team, comprising top security officials from the country's security agencies, will be supervised by President Museveni. The investigation comes after assailants attacked the car carrying the minister and his daughter, Brenda. She died in the attack while the minister sustained gunshot wounds. Critics say recent attacks targeting high-profile individuals have failed to lead to the arrest of the mastermind. They worry that if the assailants are not caught, they will be emboldened to carry out additional attacks. Godbert Tumushabe tells me that the investigating team must prove to Ugandans that the assailants will be apprehended and dealt with according to the full force of the law.
In principle, I would say this is a welcome development, that the high-profile nature of the case involving General Katumba Wamala requires a high-profile investigation, because the attempted assassination basically exposed the gaps within the security system to the extent that it makes you feel like nobody is actually safe, that you can have assassins attempt to assassinate a former chief of defense forces and then they are able to escape, and there is no mechanism to have them apprehended or even the intelligence to know that this was going to happen. I think the challenge that we have is that, like many other things in this country, you have almost the top security people, the top security leadership being the part of the investigation. And therefore, I find fault in the way these kinds of processes are constituted, because normally when you constitute operations at that level, then you have problems of accountability.
These intelligence officials are supposed to report directly to President Museveni. How significant is this?
The significance of this is that one could expect that there is expeditious and very thorough investigations, because this is the committee is reporting to the president. In practice, one would say that maybe the difference is not even there, because generally, in their normal course of business, these same officials actually report to the president. Especially in practice, that's how we know it. And therefore, I don't think that that makes a huge difference. Essentially, the point I'm making is that maybe that the president is directly overseeing the investigations could be the only difference, and that could probably help make sure that the investigations are done expeditiously and the report is put out in the manner that that probably gives assurance to the public that this matter can be brought to an end.
I understand some Ugandans are expressing skepticism about the effectiveness of this investigative team, because they said this is not the first time a high-profile person has been attacked or an attempted assassination made against a person. So they are really skeptical whether something will come out of this. What are your thoughts?
Well, the skepticism is very well founded, because Ugandans are used to these kinds of investigations. There have been similar cases of the same nature, involving high-profile people, some of them are Muslim clerics. A good number of them have been assassinated. Senior security officials, especially in the police. Another case involved a member of parliament, the late Abiriga, who was a member of parliament from West Nile. And at no point have we seen the current government conducting investigations into these assassinations and coming out with a conclusive report that puts the matter to rest. And therefore, I can fully understand why any Ugandan would be skeptical about this investigation.
Well, Godbe, I've heard some Ugandans say that investigations are conducted, reports are written, yet reports are not released to the public and nothing is done about it. Only insults are hurled to the so-called or alleged perpetrators, calling them pigs and all that. What do you think will be different this time, or do you expect this time to be different?
Yes, in a good number of cases, investigations are held, even when they are not announced, by the way. We should be able to assume that whenever there is a case of assassination involving high-profile people, there is always investigation, especially by the Uganda police. But in all these cases, those reports, there have been no reports produced and made public to be able to inform the population of what exactly transpired. So while the announcement of this joint operations committee that is a welcome idea, I think the point that I need to emphasize that I cannot vouch for the fact that the process is going to be conducted and concluded, and then as public we know what transpired.
Godbe Tumushabe is the head of the Great Lakes Institute for Strategic Studies. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. The World Health Organization, or WHO, warns many lives will be lost to COVID-19 unless at least 10% of all countries' populations are vaccinated by September. The WHO says the U.S. is the only country to make a firm commitment to share 80 million doses to other countries by the end of June, but that falls far short of the quarter of a billion doses needed to reach its goal. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
More than 2 billion doses of COVID-19 vaccine have been dispersed in 212 countries. However, the World Health Organization says the distribution has been far from equal. It notes 75% of doses have gone to just 10 countries, with three countries, China, the United States, and India, accounting for 60% of all doses. Senior advisor to the WHO Director General, Bruce Aylward, says 0.5% of doses have gone to the lower income and lowest income countries that account for about 10% of world population.
So we're increasingly seeing a two-track recovery and rollout of the vaccines with that high coverage deep into the high-risk populations and younger populations, even in high-income and producing countries, while in the lower-income countries, we're still struggling to get sufficient product just to be able to vaccinate the healthcare workers, older population.
Aylward says immunizing healthcare workers and older people is key to getting out of the global health, societal, and economic crisis. To achieve that, he says, rich countries must donate a quarter of a billion doses to low-income countries through the end of September. He adds at least 100 million must be donated through June and July.
That's what we need to get the system going. Now, we had a great start yesterday with the U.S. announcing it's going to contribute up to 80 million doses, and it gave the first 25 million doses that it would be donating, 75% of that through COVAX yesterday. That's an important start. We need many other countries to be joining, and importantly for the U.S., right, crucially, is they said these doses are going to come in June.
COVAX, the global vaccine sharing facility, aims to provide 2 billion doses of COVID-19 vaccine to low and middle income countries by the end of 2021. A report by the International Monetary Fund on May 31st says by vaccinating 60% of the global population against COVID-19 by the middle of 2022, the world would reap an economic benefit of more than $9 trillion over the coming 3 to 5 years. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
Niliwaza nikakosa jibu. Nikabaki mpweke na ghadhabu. Kumbe hana adabu. Upole wangu ndo unanisulubu. Chozi linitoke. Kuficha aibu za ndani limradi sikushushe na upole kama rafiki.
I don't like another man on your timetable. I don't like it, even the homies you running it, you calling your friend. I don't like the way you're getting high without me. I dislike it. You rolling with the wrong ones, you looking funny. Whoa, 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 yeah. You're a blessing from the highest, I can guarantee. Keeping it private on the regular is what you need. Step out the hot box and dance for me. Shake off the boobies with an NC. No, go, go, susang, and ya, kababa, loki. Anytime you show, I go hinduka. Anytime you touch me, I lose control. No, go, go, susang, and ya, kuka, gache, baby. In any case, there is a kunyakundira. In any case, tonight it is dangerous. We wildin', we wildin', wildin' with my baby. Looking serious, but I know you're super high, moving curious. Your cup's so full with a jetty on the rocks tonight. Give you about an hour and you're by my side. Put a tecato, talk to me. Mazimisi nova nazukori. I need a delay, I need you around me. Come to think about it, you're the reason I've been empty. You're a blessing from the highest, I can guarantee. Keep it private on the regular, is what you need. Step out the hot box and dance for me. Shake off the groupies at the Nancy. No, go, go, susang, and ya, kababa, roloki. Anytime you show, I go hinduka. Anytime you touch me, I lose control. No, go, go, susang, and ya, kuka, gache, baby. In any case, there is a kunyakundira. In any case, tonight it is dangerous. Why then everybody? Why then everybody? Ooh, ooh, ooh.
Was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Bill Eagle, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a clear pot of water is never hot-tempered. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.